devil with the rebels. You're talking nonsense. Nonsense. I could shoot you very easily. It would be a pleasure for me. You would have been resisting arrest. I don't doubt it. You must have had plenty of practice. I was frightened, but I was even more frightened of showing my fear. That would unleash him. Like a savage dog, he was safer while he barked. Why would you have arrested me? I asked. The embassy would want to know that. At 4 o'clock this morning, a police station was attacked. One man was killed.
A policeman?
Yes. Good. He said, Do not pretend that you have courage. You're very frightened. Look at your hand. I had wiped it once or twice against my pajama trousers to get rid of the moisture. I gave a bad imitation of a laugh. The night's hot. My conscience is quite clear. I was in bed by 4 o'clock. What happened to the other policemen? I suppose they ran away.
Yes. We shall deal with them in due course. They left their arms behind when they ran away. That was a bad mistake.
The Tontonmacut came streaming out of the kitchen quarters. It was odd to be surrounded by men in sunglasses in the murk of the early dawn. Captain Conquesser made a sign to one of them, and he hit me on the mouth, cutting my lip.
"Resisting arrest," Captain Conquesser said. "There has to be a struggle. Then, if we are polite, we will show your body to the chargé. What is his name? I forget names easily."
I could feel my nerve going. Courage, even in the brave, sleeps before breakfast, and I was never brave. I found it needed an effort to stay upright in my chair, for I had a horrible desire to fling myself at Captain Conquesser's feet. I knew the move would be fatal. One didn't think twice about shooting trash.
"I will tell you what happened," Captain Conquesser said. "The policeman on duty was strangled. He was probably asleep. A man with a limp took his gun. A Métis took his revolver. They kicked open the door where the others were sleeping,
and they let them get away.
They would have shot my men. Sometimes they spare the police.
There must be a lot of men with limps in Port-au-Prince.
Then where is Joseph? He should be sleeping here. Someone recognized Filippo, and he is not at his home. When did you last see him? Where?"
He signaled to the same man. This time the man kicked me hard on the shin, while another snatched the chair from under me, so that I found myself where I didn't wish to be, at Captain Conquesser's feet. His shoes were a horrible red-brown. I knew that I had to get upright again, or I would be finished, but my leg hurt me, and I wasn't sure I could stand. I was in an absurd position, sitting there on the floor as though at an informal party. Everyone was waiting for me to do my turn. Perhaps when I stood up, they would kick me down again. That might be their idea of a party joke. I remember Joseph's broken hip. It was safer to stay where I was. But I stood up. My right leg gave a shoot of pain. I leant back for support against the balustrade of the veranda. Captain Conquesser changed the position of his gun to cover me, but without any haste. He had an attitude of great comfort in the chaise longue. Indeed, he looked as though he owned the place. Perhaps that was his intention. I said,
"What were you saying?"
"Oh, yes. I went last night with Joseph to a voodoo ceremony. Filippo was there. But we didn't speak. I left before it was over."
"Why?"
I was disgusted.
"You were disgusted by the religion of the Haitian people?"
"Every man to his taste." The men in sunglasses came a little nearer. The glasses were turned towards Captain Conquesser. If only I could have seen one pair of eyes and the expression. I was daunted by the anonymity. Captain Conquesser said,
"You are so frightened of me that you have pissed in your pantalon."
I realized that what he said was true. I could feel the wet and the warmth. I was dripping humiliatingly on the boards. He had got what he wanted, and I would have done better to have stayed on the floor at his feet.
"Hit him again," Captain Conquesser told the man.
"Dégoûtant," a voice said.
Tout à fait dégoûtant. I was as astonished as they were. The American accent with which the words were spoken had to me all the glow and vigor of Mrs. Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic. The grapes of wrath were trampled out in them, and there was a flash of the terrible swift sword. They stopped my opponent with his fist raised to strike. Mrs. Smith had appeared at the opposite end of the veranda behind Captain Concasseur, and he had to lose his attitude of lazy detachment in order to see who it was who spoke, so that the gun no longer covered me, and I moved out of reach of the fist. Mrs. Smith was dressed in a kind of old colonial nightgown, and her hair was done up in metal rollers, which gave her an oddly cubist air. She stood there firmly in the dawn light, and let them have it in sharp, fragmented phrases torn out of Hugo's self-taught. She told them of the brute horrible which had roused her and her husband from their sleep. She accused them of lâcheté in striking an unarmed man. She demanded their warrant to be here at all. Warrant, and again warrant. But here Hugo's vocabulary failed her. Montrez-moi votre warrant. Votre warrant, où est-il? The mysterious word menaced them more than the words they understood. Captain Concasseur began to speak. Madame, and she turned on him the focus of her fierce, short-sighted eyes. You, she said. Oh, yes, I've seen you before. You are the woman striker. Hugo's had no word for that. Only English could serve her indignation now. She advanced on him, all her hard-won vocabulary forgotten. How dare you come here flourishing a revolver? Give it to me. And she held out her hand for it, as though he were a child with a catapult. Captain Concasseur may not have understood her English, but he understood very well the gesture. As though he were guarding a precious object from an angry mother, he buttoned the gun back inside the holster. "Get out of that chair, you black scum! Stand up when you speak to me!" she added, in defense of all her past, as though this echo of Nashville racism had burnt her tongue. You are a disgrace to your color. Who is this woman? Captain Concasseur asked me weakly. The wife of the presidential candidate. You have met her before. I think for the first time he remembered the scene at Filippo's funeral. He had lost his grip. His men stared at him through their dark glasses, waiting for orders which didn't come. Mrs. Smith had recovered her grasp on Hugo's vocabulary. How she must have worked all that long morning when Mr. Smith and I visited Duvalierville. She said in her atrocious accent, "You have searched, you have not found, you can go." Except for the absence of certain nouns, the sentences would have been suitable ones for the second lesson. Captain Concasseur hesitated. Too ambitiously, she attempted both the subjunctive and the future tense, and got them wrong, but he recognized very well what she intended to say. "If you don't go, I will fetch my husband." He capitulated. He led his men out, and soon they were going down the drive, more noisily than they had come, laughing hollowly in an attempt to heal their wounded pride. "Who was that?"
"One of Jones's new friends," I said.
"I shall speak to Mr. Jones about it at the first opportunity. You can't touch pitch without—" "Your mouth is bleeding. You had better come upstairs, and I will wash it in Listerine. Mr. Smith and I never travel anywhere without a bottle of Listerine."
3. "Does it hurt?" Martha asked me.
"Not much," I said. "Now."
I could not remember a time when we had been so alone and so at peace. The long hours of the afternoon faded behind the mosquito netting over the bedroom window. When I looked back on that afternoon, it seemed to me we had been granted the distant sight of a promised land. We had come to the edge of a desert. The milk and honey awaited us. Our spies went by, carrying their burden of grapes. To what false gods did we turn, then? What else could we have done other than we did? Never before had Martha come of her own will, unpressed, to the Trianon. We had never slept before in my bed.
It was for half an hour only, but the sleep was deeper than any I have known since. I woke, flinching from her mouth with my wounded gum, and I said, "I received a letter of apology from Jones. He told Concasseur that he took it as a personal insult that a friend of his should be treated like that. He threatened to break off relations."
"What relations?"
"God knows. He asked me to have a drink with him tonight, at 10. I shan't go." We could hardly see each other now in the dusk. Every time she spoke, I thought it was to say that she could stay no longer. Luis was back in South America, reporting to his Foreign Office, but there was always Angel. I knew that she had invited some friends of his for tea, but tea doesn't last very long. The Smiths were out, another meeting with the Secretary for Social Welfare. This time he had asked them to come alone, and Mrs. Smith had taken the Hugo self-taught with her in case interpretations were required. Now I thought I heard a door slam, and I said to Martha, "I think the Smiths are back."
"I don't care about the Smiths," she said. She put her hand on my chest and said, "Oh, I'm tired."
"A good tired or a bad tired?"
"A bad tired."
"What's wrong?" It was a stupid question in our position, but I wanted to hear the words I often spoke on her own tongue.
"I'm tired of not being alone. I'm tired of people. I'm tired of Angel,"
I said in amazement. "Angel?"
"Today I gave him a whole box of new puzzles, enough to occupy him for a week. I wish I could have that week with you."
"A week?"
"I know. It's not long enough, is it? This isn't an adventure anymore."
"It stopped being that when I was in New York."
"Yes."
Somewhere from far away in the town came the sound of shots. "Somebody's being killed," I said.
"Haven't you heard?" she asked.
Two more shots came.
"I mean about the executions."
"No, Petit Pierre hasn't been up for days. Joseph has disappeared. I'm cut off from news."
"As a reprisal for the attack on the police station, they've taken two men from prison to shoot them in the cemetery."
"In the dark?"
"It's more impressive. They've rigged up arc lights with a television camera. All the school children have to attend. Orders from Papa Doc."
"Then you'd better wait for the audience to disperse," I said.
"Yes. That's all it means to us. We aren't concerned."
"No. We wouldn't make very good rebels, you and I."
"I don't imagine Joseph will either, with that damaged hip."
"Or Filippo without his brain. I wonder if he's got Baudelaire in his breast pocket to stop the bullets."
"Don't be too hard on me, then," she said, "because I'm German, and the Germans did nothing." She moved her hand as she spoke, and my desire came back, so that I didn't bother to ask her what she meant. Not with Luis safely away in South America, and Angel occupied with his puzzles, and the Smiths out of sight and hearing. I could imagine the taste of milk on her breasts and the taste of honey between her thighs, and I could imagine for a moment that I was entering the promised land. But the spasm of hope was soon over, and she spoke as though her thoughts had not for a moment left their furrow. She said,
"Haven't the French a word for going into the streets?"
"My mother must have gone into the streets, I suppose, unless it was her lover who gave her the resistance medal."
"My father went into the streets, too, in 1930, but he became a war criminal. Action is dangerous, isn't it?"
"Yes, we've learned from their example." It was time to dress and go downstairs. Every stair down was a stair nearer Port-au-Prince. The Smith's door stood open, and Mrs. Smith looked up as we went by. Mr. Smith sat with his hat in his hands, and she had laid her hand on the back of his neck. After all, they were lovers too. "Well," I said as we walked to the car, "they've seen us. Afraid?"
"No, relieved," Martha said.
I went back into the hotel, and Mrs. Smith called to me from the first floor. I wondered whether, like one of the old inhabitants of Salem, I was to be denounced for adultery. Would Martha have to wear a scarlet letter? I have no idea why, but I had assumed them to be Puritan because they were vegetarian. Yet it was not the passion of love which was caused by acidity, and they were both enemies of hate. I went reluctantly upstairs and found them in the same attitude. Mrs. Smith said, with an odd note of defiance, as though she had read my thoughts and resented them, "I would have liked to have said good evening to Mrs. Pineda." I put it as blackly as I knew how. She had to hurry home to her child, and Mrs. Smith did not so much as wince. She said, "She is a woman I would have liked to know better." Why had I assumed it was only for the colored races that she felt charity? Was it my guilt which had deciphered disapproval on her face the other night? Or was she the kind of woman who, when she had once tended a man, forgave him everything? I had been shriven, perhaps, by the Listerine. She took her hand from her husband's neck to lay it on his hair. I said, "It's not too late. She'll come back another day." "We go home tomorrow," she said. "Mr. Smith despairs."
"Of a vegetarian center?"
"Of everything here." He looked up, and there were tears in the old pale eyes. What an absurd fancy it had been for him to pose as a politician. He said,
"You heard the shots?"
"Yes."
"We passed the children on the way from school," he said. "I had never conceived, when we were freedom riders, Mrs. Smith and I."
"One can't condemn a color, dear," she said.
"I know, I know."
"What happened with the minister?"
"The meeting was a short one. He wanted to attend the ceremony."
"Ceremony?"
"At the cemetery."
"Does he know you are leaving?"
"Oh, yes. I had made my decision before that ceremony. The minister had been thinking the affair over, and he had come to the conclusion that I was not, after all, a sucker. The alternative was that I was as crooked as himself. I had come here to get money, not to spend it, so he showed me a method. It only meant splitting three ways instead of two with someone in charge of public works. As I understood it, I would have to pay for some materials, but not for many materials, and they would really be bought out of our share of the pickings."
"And how were they going to get the pickings?"
"The government would guarantee wages. We would hire the labor at a much lower wage, and at the end of a month the laborers would be dismissed. Then we'd keep the project idle for 2 months, and afterwards engage a fresh lot of workers. Of course, the guaranteed wages during the idle months would go into our own pockets, apart from what we paid out for materials, and the commission on these would keep the head of the Public Works Ministry, I think it was the Public Works Ministry, happy. He was very proud of the scheme. He pointed out that in the end there might even possibly be a vegetarian center."
"The scheme sounds full of holes to me."
"I didn't let him go into the details. I think he would have patched up all the holes as they occurred, patched them up out of the pickings."
Mrs. Smith said with sorrowful tenderness, "Mr. Smith came here with such high hopes."
"You too, dear."
"One lives and learns," Mrs. Smith said. "It is not the end."
"Learning comes easier to the young. Forgive me, Mr. Brown, if I sound kind of dejected, but we didn't want you to misunderstand our leaving your hotel. You have made us very welcome. We've been very happy here under your roof."
"I'm glad to have you. Are you catching the Medea? She's due back tomorrow."
"No, we won't wait for her. I've written out our address for you at home. We are going to fly to Santo Domingo tomorrow, and we'll stay there a few days at least. Mrs. Smith wants to see Columbus's tomb. I'm expecting some vegetarian literature to arrive here on the next boat, if you will be kind enough to redirect it."
"I'm sorry about the center, but you know, Mr. Smith, it would never have done.
I realize that now. Perhaps we seem rather comic figures to you, Mr. Brown.
Not comic, I said with sincerity. Heroic.
Oh, we're not made at all in that mold. I'll say good night to you, Mr. Brown, now, if you'll excuse me. I'm feeling kind of exhausted this evening.
It was very hot and damp in the city, Mrs. Smith explained, and she touched his hair again as though she were touching some tissue of great value.
Chapter 3. 1.
Next day I saw the Smiths off at the airport. There was no sign of Petit Pierre, and yet surely the departure of a presidential candidate rated one paragraph in his column, even though he would have had to omit the final macabre scene which took place outside the post office. Mr. Smith asked me to stop the car in the center of the square, and I thought he intended to take a photograph. Instead, he got out, carrying his wife's handbag, and the beggars approached from all directions. There was a low babble of half-articulated phrases, and I saw a policeman run down the steps of the post office. Mr. Smith opened the handbag and began to scatter notes, gourds and dollars indiscriminately.
"For God's sake," I said.
One or two of the beggars gave high, unnerving screams. I saw Hamid standing amazed at the door of his shop. The red light of evening turned the pools and mud the color of laterite. The last money was scattered, and the police began to close in on their prey. Men with two legs kicked down men with one. Men with two arms grasped those who were armless by their torsos and threw them to the ground. As I hustled Mr. Smith back into my car, I saw Jones. He sat in a car behind his tonton driver, and he looked bewildered, worried, for once in his life lost. Mr. Smith said,
"Well, my dear, I guess they won't squander that any worse than I would have done."
I saw the Smiths onto their plane, dined alone, and then drove to the Villa Creole. I was curious to see Jones. The chauffeur was slumped at the bottom of the stairs. He watched me with suspicion, but he let me pass. A voice from the landing above cried angrily, "La volonté du diable!" and a negro, who flashed a gold ring under the light, went by me. Jones greeted me as though I were an old school friend whom he had not seen for years, and with a hint of patronage, because our relative positions had changed since those days.
"Come in, old man, I'm glad to see you. I expected you the other night. Forgive the confusion. Try that chair, you'll find it pretty snug."
The chair was certainly warm. It still held the heat of the last angry occupant. Three packs of cards were scattered over the table. The air was blue with cigar smoke, and an ashtray had toppled over, leaving some butts on the floor.
"Who's your friend?" I asked. "Someone in the Treasury Department. A bad loser."
"Gin rummy?"
"He shouldn't have raised the stakes halfway through when he was well ahead. But you don't argue with someone in the Treasury, do you? In any case, at the end, the old ace of spades turned up, and it was over in a flash. I'm 2,000 to the good. But he paid me in gourds, not dollars. What's your poison?"
"Have you a whiskey?"
"I have next to everything, old man. You wouldn't fancy a dry martini?"
I would have preferred a whiskey, but he seemed anxious to show off the riches of his store. So, "If it's very dry," I said.
10 to 1, old man."
He unlocked the cupboard and drew out a leather travelling case, a half-bottle of gin, a half-bottle of vermouth, 4 metal beakers, a shaker. It was an elegant, expensive set, and he laid it reverently on the tumbled table, as though he were an auctioneer showing a prized antique. I couldn't help commenting on it.
"Aspirys?" I asked.
"As good as," he replied quickly, and began to mix the cocktails.
"It must feel a little odd finding itself here," I said, "so far from W1. "It's used to much stranger places," he said. "I had it with me in Burma during the war."
"It's come out remarkably unscathed."
"I had it furbished up again."
He turned away from me to find a lime, and I took a closer look at the case. Asprey's trademark was visible inside the lid. He came back with the lime and saw me looking.
"I'm caught, old man. It is from Asprey's. I didn't want to seem pretentious, that's all. As a matter of fact, there's quite a history around that case. Tell me. Try the drink first and see if it's to your taste."
"It's fine."
"I got that case as a result of a bet with some other chaps in the outfit. The Brigadier had one like it, and I couldn't help envying him. I used to dream of a case like that on patrol, the shaker clinking with the ice. I had two young chaps out with me from London, never been much further than Bond Street before. Well lined, both of them. They teased me about the Brigadier's cocktail set. Once we got pretty near to the end of our water, they challenged me to find a stream before night. If I did, I could have a cocktail case like that next time anyone went home. I don't know whether I've told you that I can smell water."
"Was that the time you lost the whole platoon?" I asked. He looked up at me over his glass, and I'm sure he read my thoughts.
"That was another occasion," he said, and changed the subject abruptly. "How are Smith and Mrs. Smith?"
"You saw what happened by the post office?"
"Yes."
"It was the last installment of American aid. They left this evening on the plane. They sent their regards to you."
"I wish I'd seen more of them," Jones said. "There's something about him."
He added surprisingly, "He reminded me of my father. Not physically, I mean, but, well, a sort of goodness."
"Yes, I know what you mean. I don't remember my father. To tell you the truth, my memory's a bit dim, too."
"Let's say the father we would have liked to have."
"That's it, old man, exactly. Don't let your martini get warm. I always felt that Mr. Smith and I had a bit in common, horses out of the same stable."
I listened with astonishment. What could a saint possibly have in common with a rogue? Jones gently closed the cocktail case, and then, taking a cloth from the table, he began to stroke the leather as tenderly as Mrs. Smith had smoothed her husband's hair, and I thought, innocence, perhaps.
"I'm sorry," Jones said, "about that affair with Concasseur. I told him if he touched a friend of mine again, I was finished with the lot of them."
"Be careful what you say. They're dangerous."
"I have no fear of them. They need me too much, old man. Did you know young Filippo came to see me?"
"Yes."
"Just imagine what I could have done for him. They realize that."
"Have you a Bren for sale?"
"I've got myself, old man. That's better than a Bren. All the rebels need is a man who knows the way around. Think of it. On a clear day you can see Port-au-Prince from the Dominican border."
"The Dominicans will never march."
"They are not needed. Give me 50 Haitians with a month's training, and Papa Doc would be on a plane to Kingston. I wasn't in Burma for nothing. I've thought a lot about it. I've studied the map. Those raids near Cap Haitien were a folly, the way they were done. I know exactly where I'd put my feint and where I'd strike."
"Why didn't you go with Filippo?"
"I was tempted. Oh, I was tempted, all right. But I've got a deal on here, which only happens once in a man's life. It means a fortune if I can get away with it."
"Where to?"
"Where to?"
"Get away where to?"
He laughed happily. "Anywhere in the world, old man. Once before I nearly brought it off in Stanleyville, but I was dealing with a lot of savages and they got suspicious."
"And they aren't suspicious here?"
"They are educated. You can always get round the educated."
While he poured out two more martinis, I was wondering what form his swindle took. One thing at least was certain. He was living better than he had done in his prison cell. He had even put on a little weight. I asked him directly, "What are you up to, Jones?"
"Laying the foundations of a fortune, old man. Why not come in with me? It's not a long-term project. Any moment now I'll have the bird by the tail, but I could do with a partner. That's what I wanted to talk to you about, but you never came.
There's $250,000 in it, perhaps more if we keep our nerve.
And the partner's job?
To complete the deal, I have to do a spot of travelling. I don't want a man I can rely on to watch things here while I'm away.
You don't trust Concasseur?
I don't trust one of them. It's not a question of colour, but think of it, old man. $250,000, pure profit. I can't take any chances. I'd have to deduct a little of it for expenses. $10,000 would probably cover that, and then we'd divide the rest. The hotel's not doing too well, is it? And think what you could do with your share. There are islands in the Caribbean just waiting for development. A beach, an hotel, an airstrip. You'll end a millionaire, old man.
I suppose it was my Jesuit education which reminded me of that moment when, from a high mountain above the desert, the devil displayed all the kingdoms of the world. I wondered whether the devil really had them to offer, or whether it was all a gigantic bluff. I looked around the room in the Villa Creole for evidence of the thrones and powers. There was a record player, which Jones must have bought at Hamid's. He would hardly have carried it all the way from America in the Medea, for it was a cheap enough machine. Beside it, rather suitably, lay a disc of Edith Piaf, Je ne regrette rien. And there was little other sign of personal possessions, little sign that he had been enabled to draw much of his wealth in advance for the goods which he had to deliver.
What goods?
Well, old man, you haven't given me a very clear idea of what you want me to do.
I can't let you into it very well, can I, until I know you are with me?
How can I tell whether I'm with you if I know nothing? He looked at me across the scattered cards. The lucky ace of spades lay face upwards.
It comes down to a matter of trust, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
If only we'd been in the same outfit during the war, old man. Under those conditions you learn to trust.
I said, "What division were you with?" And he replied, without the slightest hesitation, "Five Corps." He even elaborated a little. 77th Brigade. He had the answers right. I checked them that night at the Trianon in a history which some client had left behind of the Burma campaign. But even then it occurred to my suspicious mind that it was possible he possessed the same book and had drawn his data from it. But I was unjust to him. He really had been in Imphal.
What hope have you got for your hotel?
Very little.
You couldn't find a purchaser if you tried. Any day now you'll be dispossessed. They'll say you are not making proper use of your property and take it over.
It might happen.
What is it, old man? Woman trouble?
I suppose my eyes gave me away.
You're too old for fidelity, old man. Think of what you can get for $150,000.
I noticed that the reward had increased.
You can go further than the Caribbean. Do you know Bora Bora? There's nothing there but an airstrip and a rest house, but with a little capital. And the girls, you've never seen such girls. The mothers had them off the Americans 20 years ago. Mayor Catherine can't show you better.
What will you do with your money? I would never have thought that Jones's flat brown eyes, like copper coins, had the capacity to dream, yet they moistened now with some kind of emotion.
Oh, man, I've one particular spot in mind not far from here. A coral reef and white sand, real white sand, that you could build castles with. And behind are green slopes as smooth as real turf and God-made natural hazards, a perfect spot for a golf course. I'll build a clubhouse, bungalow suites with showers. It will be more exclusive than any other golf club in the Caribbean. Do you know what I mean to call it? The Saib House.
You don't suggest I'm to be your partner there?
One can't have partners in a dream, old man. Conflicts would arise. I've got the place planned as I want it to the last detail.
I wondered whether those were the blueprints Filippo had seen.
I've gone an awfully long way to get there, but it's in sight now. I can even see exactly where to put the 19th hole.
You're keen on golf?
I don't play myself. I've somehow never had the time. It's the idea that appeals to me. I'm going to get a first-class social hostess, someone good-looking with background. I did think at the beginning of having bunny girls, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized they would be out of place in a golf club of class.
Were you planning all this in Stanleyville?
I've been planning it for 20 years, old man, and now the moment's nearly here. Have another martini.
No, I must be going.
I'm going to have a long bar made of coral called the Desert Island Bar, with a barman trained at the Ritz. I'm going to have chairs made out of driftwood. Course will make them comfortable with cushions. Parakeets on the curtains and a big brass telescope in the window focused on the 18th hole.
We'll talk about it again.
I've never talked about it to anyone before, anyone who could understand what I have in mind, that is. I used to talk to my boy in Stanleyville when I was thinking out the details, but the poor little bugger hadn't got a clue.
Thanks for the martinis.
I'm glad you like the case. When I looked back, he had taken off the cloth and was polishing it again. He called after me, "We'll have another talk soon, if only you'd agree in principle."
2. I had no wish to return to the Trianon, which was empty now of guests, and I had received no word from Martha all day, so I was drawn back to the casino as the nearest equivalent of a home. But it was a casino much changed since the night when I had met Martha. There were no tourists, and few residents of Port-au-Prince cared to venture out after dark. Only one roulette table was functioning, and only one player was seated there, an Italian engineer whom I knew slightly, called Luigi. He worked with the erratic electricity plant. No private company could have kept a casino running under these conditions, and the government had taken it over. Now, every night they made a loss, but it was a loss in gourds, and the government could always print more. The croupier sat with a scowl on his face. Perhaps he wondered where his pay would come from. Even with 2 zeros, the chances in favor of the bank were too fine. With so few players, 1 or 2 losses en plein, and the bank would be down for the night.
"Winning?" I asked Luigi.
"I'm 150 gourds up," he said. "I haven't the heart to leave the poor devil." And on the next run he made another 15.
"Do you remember this place in the old days?"
"No, I wasn't here then."
They had tried to economize on the lighting, so we played in a cavernous obscurity. I played without interest, placing my tokens on the first column, and won also. The face of the croupier grew darker.
"I've got a good mind," said Luigi, "to put all my winnings on red and give him a chance to recuperate."
"But you might win," I said.
"There's always the bar. They must make a good cut out of the drinks."
We bought whiskies. It seemed too cruel to order rum, though whiskey was hardly wise for me on top of the dry martinis. Already I began to feel...
"Why, if it isn't Mr. Jones!"
a voice called from the end of the salle, and I turned to see the purser of the Medea advancing on me with a damp and welcoming hand.
"You've got the name wrong," I said. "I'm Brown, not Jones."
"Breaking the bank?" he asked jovially.
"It doesn't need much breaking. I thought you never ventured into town as far as this."
"I don't follow my own advice," he said, and winked. "I went first to Mayor Catherine's, but the girl has got family trouble. She won't be there till tomorrow."
"Nobody else you fancied?"
"I always like to eat off the same plate. How are Mr. and Mrs. Smith?"
"They flew out today, disappointed."
"Ah, he should have come with us. Any trouble with the exit visa?"
"We got it through in 3 hours. I've never seen the immigration department and the police work faster. They must have wanted to get rid of him." Political trouble? I think the Ministry for Social Welfare found his ideas upsetting. We had a few more drinks and watched Luigi lose a few gourds for conscience' sake. He longs to be off. He cannot endure this place. His temper will not be right until we are at sea again. And the man with the tin hat? Did you leave him safely in Santo Domingo? I felt an odd nostalgia when I talked of my fellow passengers, perhaps because it was the last time that I had experienced a sense of security. The last time, too, I had possessed any real hope. I had been returning to Martha, and I had believed that everything might be changed. The tin hat? Don't you remember? He recited at our concert. Oh, yes, poor fellow. We left him safely behind, all right, in the cemetery. He had a heart attack before we landed. We gave Baxter the tribute of 2 seconds' silence while the ball bounced and chinked for Luigi alone. He won a few more gourds and rose with a gesture of despair. And Fernandez? I asked, the black man who wept. He proved invaluable, the purser said. He knew all the ropes. He took charge of everything. You see, it turned out that he was an undertaker. The only thing which worried him was Mr. Baxter's faith. In the end, he put him in the Protestant cemetery because he found in his pocket a calendar about the future. Old something. Old Moore's Almanac? That was it. I wonder what the entry was for Baxter. I looked to see. It was not very personal. A hurricane was going to cause great damage. There would be a severe sickness in the royal family, and the price of steel shares would rise several points. Let's go, I said. An empty casino is worse than an empty tomb. Luigi was already cashing in his chips, and I did the same. The night outside was heavy with the usual storm. Have you got a taxi? I asked the purser. No, he wanted to be paid off. They don't like to stay around at night. I'll drive you to the ship. The lights across the playground flashed on and off and on. Je suis le drapeau haïtien. Uni est indivisible. François Duvalier. The F had fused, so it read François Duvalier. We passed Columbus's statue and came to the port and the Medea. A light shone down along the gangplank upon a policeman standing at the foot. There was a light shining, too, onto the bridge from the captain's cabin. I looked up at the deck, where I had sat watching the passengers reel by me on their morning rounds. In port, she was the only ship there, the Medea seemed oddly dwarfed. It was the empty sea which gave the little boat her pride and magnitude. Our footsteps ground upon coal dust, and the taste of grit lodged between our teeth. Come on board for a last drink. No, if I did, I might want to stay. What would you do then? The captain would ask to see your exit visa. That fellow would ask first, I said, looking at the policeman who stood at the foot of the gangplank. Oh, he is a good friend of mine. The purser mimicked the action of a man drinking and pointed towards me. The policeman grinned back. You see, he has no objection. All the same, I said, I won't come up. I've mixed too many drinks tonight. But I lingered at the plank. And Mr. Jones? The purser asked. What has become of Mr. Jones? He's doing well. I liked him, the purser said. For a man of such ambiguity, whom we all trusted so little, Jones had a knack of winning friendship. He told me he was Libra, a birthday in October, so I looked him up. In Old Moore, what did you find? An artistic temperament, ambitious, successful in literary enterprises, but as for the future, I could find only an important press conference by General de Gaulle and electrical storms in South Wales. He tells me he's about to make a fortune of $250,000. A literary enterprise? Hardly that. He invited me to be his partner. So you will be rich too? No, I refused.
I used to have my dreams of making a fortune. Perhaps I'll be able to tell you one day about the traveling art gallery. It was the most successful dream I ever had, but I had to get out quick, and so I came here and found my hotel. Do you think I'd give up that security?
You think the hotel security?
It's the nearest I've ever come to it.
When Mr. Jones is a rich man, you will be sorry you did not give up that kind of security.
Perhaps he'll lend me enough to carry on with my hotel until the tourists return.
Yes, I think he is a generous man in his way. He gave me a very large tip, but it was in Congo currency, and the bank wouldn't change it. We shall be here till tomorrow night at least. Bring Mr. Jones to see us.
The lightning began to play over the slopes of Pétionville. Sometimes a blade quivered in the ground long enough to carve out of the dark the shape of a palm or the corner of a roof. The air was full of coming rain, and the low sound reminded me of voices chanting the responses at school. We said good night.
Part 3, Chapter 1, 1. I found it hard to sleep. The lightning flashed on and off as regularly as Papa Doc's publicity in the park, and only when the rain ceased for a while did a little air filter through the mosquito screens. I thought quite a lot about Jones's promised fortune. If I could really share it, would Martha leave her husband? But it was not money which held her, it was Angel. He would be happy enough, I could imagine myself persuading her, if I pensioned him off with a weekly issue of Puzzles and Bourbon Biscuits. I fell asleep and dreamt I was a boy kneeling at the communion rail in the college chapel in Monte Carlo. The priest came down the row and placed in each mouth a Bourbon Biscuit, but when he came to me, he passed me by. The communicants on either side came and went away, but I knelt obstinately on. Again the priest distributed the biscuits and left me out. I stood up then and walked sullenly away down the aisle, which had become an immense aviary, where parrots stood in ranks, chained to their crosses. Someone called out sharply behind me, "Brown! Brown!" But I was not certain whether that was my name or not, for I didn't turn. "Brown!" This time I awoke, and a voice came up to me from the veranda below my room. I got out of bed and went to the window, but I could see nothing through the mosquito screen. Footsteps shuffled below, and a voice further off called urgently, "Brown!" under another window. I could hardly hear it through the holy mutter of the rain. I found my torch and went downstairs. In my office I picked up the only weapon handy, the brass coffin marked R.I.P. Then I unlocked the side door and shone my torch to show that I was there. The light fell on the path leading to the bathing pool. Presently round the corner of the house and into the circle of the light came Jones. He was drenched with rain and his face was smeared with dirt. He carried a parcel under his coat to guard it from the rain. He said, "Turn out the light. Let me in quick." He followed me into the office and took the parcel from under his wet jacket. It was the traveling cocktail case. He laid it gently on my desk like a pet animal and stroked it down. He said, "Everything has gone, finished. Capote in three columns." I put out a hand to turn on the light. "Don't do that," he said. "They might see the light from the road." "They can't," I said, and pressed the switch. "Old man, I'd rather if you don't mind. I feel better in the dark." He turned out the light again. "What's that in your hand, old man?" "A coffin." He was breathing heavily. I could smell the gin. He said, "I've got to get out quick, somehow." "What happened?" "They've begun investigating. At midnight I had a call from Concasseur. I didn't even know the bloody telephone worked. Gave me a shock ringing like that, suddenly, by my ear. It had never rung before." "I suppose they fixed up the telephone when they put the poles in. You're living in a government rest house for VIPs." "Very important poofs, we call them in Imphal," Jones said with the ghost of a laugh. "I could give you a drink if you'd let me put on the light." "There isn't time, old man.
I've got to get out. Concasseur was speaking from Miami. They'd sent him to check up. He wasn't suspicious yet, only puzzled. But in the morning, when they found I've skipped...
Skipped where?
Yes, that's the question, old man. That's the $64,000 question.
The Medea's in port.
The very place.
I'll have to put on some clothes.
He followed me like a dog, leaving wet patches in his wake. I missed Mrs. Smith's help and advice, for she had a high opinion of Jones. While I dressed, he had to allow me a little light for that, he ambled nervously from wall to wall, well away from the window.
"I don't know what your game was," I said, "but surely with $250,000 at stake, you could be certain that one day they'd investigate."
"Oh, I'd thought that one out. I'd have gone over to Miami with the investigator."
"But they'd have kept you here."
"Not if I'd left a partner behind. I hadn't realized time was so short. I thought I had a week or more at least, or I'd have tried to persuade you earlier."
I stopped with one leg in my trousers and asked him with astonishment,
"You're telling me, just like that, that I was to be the fall guy?"
"Oh, no, no, old man, you exaggerate. You could be dead sure I'd have tipped you off in time for you to get into the British Embassy, if it was ever necessary, but it wouldn't have been. The investigator would have cabled okay and taken his cut, and you would have joined us afterwards."
"How big a cut had you planned for him? I know it's only of academic interest now."
"I'd allowed for all that. What I offered you, old man, was net, not gross. All yours."
"If I survived."
"One always survives, old man."
As he dried, his confidence returned.
"I've had my setbacks before. I was just as near the grand coup and the end in Stanleyville."
"If your plan had anything to do with arms," I said, "you've made a bad mistake. They've been stung before."
"How do you mean stung?"
"There was a man here last year who arranged $500,000 worth of arms for them, fully paid up in Miami. But the American authorities were tipped off, the arms were seized. The dollars, of course, stayed in the agent's pocket. Nobody knew how many real arms there had ever been. They wouldn't be taken for the same ride twice. You should have done more homework before you came here."
"My scheme was not exactly that. In fact, there were no arms at all. I don't look like a man with that much capital, do I?"
"Where did that introduction of yours come from?"
"From a typewriter, like most introductions. But you are right about the homework. I put the wrong name on the letter. I talked myself out of that one, though."
"I'm ready to go." I looked at him, where he fidgeted in a corner with a light flex. The brown eyes, the not-quite-trim officer's moustache, the grey indifferent skin. "I don't know why I'm running this risk for you, a fall guy again." I took the car out on the road with the lights off, and we cruised slowly down towards the city. Jones crouched low and whistled to keep his courage up. I think the tune dated from 1940, the Wednesday after the war. Just before the roadblock, I switched the lights on. There was a chance the militiaman was asleep, but he wasn't.
"Did you pass here tonight?" I asked.
"No, I made a detour through a couple of gardens."
"Well, there's no avoiding him now."
But he was too sleepy to be troublesome. He limped across the road and raised the barrier. His big toe was bound up in a dirty bandage, and his backside showed through a hole in his grey flannel trousers. He didn't bother to search us for arms. We drove on down, past the turning to Martha's, past the British Embassy. I slowed down there. All seemed quiet enough. The Tonton Macoute would surely have put guards on the gate if they had known of Jones's escape. I said,
"What about going in there? You'd be safe enough."
"I'd rather not, old man. I've been a bother to them before, and they won't exactly welcome me."
"You'd have a worse welcome from Papa Doc. This is your great chance."
"There are reasons, old man." He paused, and I thought he was going at last to confide in me, but,
"Oh, God," he said, "I've forgotten my cocktail case.
I left it in your office, on the desk.
Is it so important?
I love that case, old man. It's been with me everywhere. It's my luck.
I'll bring it to you tomorrow if it's so important to you.
You want to try the Medea, then?
If there's a snag, we can always come back here as a last resort.
He tried out another tune. I think it was A Nightingale Sang, but stuck.
To think, after all we've been through together, that I'd leave it.
Is it the only bet you ever won?
Bet? What do you mean, bet?
You told me you won it in a bet.
Did I?
He brooded a while.
Old man, you're running a big risk for me, and I'll be straight with you. That wasn't exactly the truth. I pinched it.
And Burma, was that not the truth either?
Oh, I was in Burma, all right. I promised that.
You pinched it from aspirates?
Not with my hands, of course.
With your wits again?
I was working at the time, something in the city. I used one of the company's checks, but I signed my own name. I wasn't going to be sent down for forgery. It was just a temporary loan. You know, it was love at first sight when I saw that case and I remembered the brigadiers.
It wasn't with you in Burma, then?
I was romancing a bit there, but I did have it with me in the Congo.
I left the car by the Columbus statue. The police must have been accustomed to seeing my car there at night, though not alone, and I went ahead of Jones to reconnoitre. It was easier than I thought. For some reason, the policeman was no longer by the gangplank, which had been kept down for latecomers from Mayor Catherine's. Perhaps he had a beat, perhaps he'd gone behind the wall to urinate. One of the crew was on guard at the top, but seeing our white faces, he let us go by. We went up to the top deck, and Jones's spirits rose. He had hardly uttered a sound since his confession. As he passed the saloon door, he said, "Remember the concert? That was a night, wasn't it? Remember Baxter and his whistle? St. Paul's will stand, London will stand." He was too good to be true, old man.
"He isn't true any more. He's dead."
"Poor bugger. That makes him sort of respectable, doesn't it?" he added with a kind of yearning. We climbed the ladder to the captain's cabin. I did not relish the interview, for I remembered his attitude to Jones after he had received the wireless inquiry from Philadelphia. Everything had gone easily up till now, but I had small hope that our luck would last. I rapped on the door, and with hardly an interval, the captain's voice came hoarse and authoritative, bidding me enter. At least I had not woken him from sleep. He was propped up in his berth, wearing a white cotton nightshirt, and he had put on very thick reading glasses, which made his eyes look like broken chips of quartz. He held a book tilted below the reading lamp, and I saw it was one of Simenon's novels, and this encouraged me a little. It seemed to be a sign that he had human interests.
"Mr. Brown," he exclaimed in surprise, like an old lady disturbed in her hotel room, and like an old lady his left hand went instinctively to the neckline of his nightshirt.
"And Major Jones," Jones added jauntily, and moved out from behind me into view.
"Oh, Mr. Jones," the captain said in a tone of distinct displeasure.
"I hope you've room for a passenger," Jones asked, with his unconvincing hilarity. "Not short of schnapps, I hope?"
"Not for a passenger. But are you a passenger? At this hour of the night, I would imagine you lack a ticket."
"I have the money to pay for one, Captain."
"And an exit visa?"
"A formality for a foreigner like myself."
"A formality which is complied with by all except the criminal classes. I think you're in trouble, Mr. Jones."
"Yes, you might say I'm a political refugee."
"Then why have you not gone to the British Embassy?"
"I felt I'd be more at home in the dear old Medea." The phrase had a good music hall ring, and perhaps that was why he repeated it. "Dear old Medea."
"You were never a welcome guest, Mr. Jones. I had too many inquiries about you."
Jones looked at me, but I could give him little help. "Captain," I said, "you know how they treat prisoners here. Surely you can stretch a rule." His white nightshirt, embroidered around the neck and cuffs, perhaps by that formidable wife of his, had a horribly judicial air. He looked down at us from the height of his bunk as from a bench.
"Mr. Brown," he said, "I have my career to consider. I must return here every month. Do you think that at my age the company would give me another command on another route, after an indiscretion such as you propose?" Jones said, "I'm sorry, I never thought of that," with a gentleness which surprised, I think, the captain, as it surprised me, for when the captain spoke again, it was all